Chapter 2. Anderson Diggs. 1. It rained steadily for the next 3 days. Anderson wandered restlessly around the house, made a trip with Peter into Augusta in the pickup for supplies she didn't really need, drank beer, and listened to old Beach Boys tunes while she made repairs around the house. Trouble was, there weren't really that many repairs that needed to be done. By the third day, she was circling the typewriter, thinking maybe she would start the new book. She knew what it was supposed to be about. A young schoolmarm and a buffalo hunter caught up in a range war in Kansas during the early 1850s, a period when everyone in the midsection of the country seemed to be tuning up for the Civil War, whether they knew it or not. It would be a good book, she thought, but she didn't think it was quite ready yet, whatever that meant. A sardonic mimic awoke in her mind, doing an Orson Welles voice, "We will write no Ota before its time." Still, her restlessness dug at her, and the signs were all there, an impatience with books, with the music, with herself, a tendency to drift off, and then she would be looking at the typewriter, wanting to wake it into some dream. Peter also seemed restless, scratching at the door to go out, and then scratching at it to come back in 5 minutes later, wandering around the place, lying down, then getting up again. "Low barometer," Anderson thought. "That's all it is. Makes us both restless, cranky." And her damned period. Usually she flowed heavy and then just stopped, like turning off a faucet. This time, she just went on leaking. Bad washer, ha-ha, she thought, with no humor at all. She found herself sitting in front of the typewriter just after dark on the second rainy day, a blank sheet rolled into the carriage. She started to type, and what came out was a bunch of X's and O's, like a kid's tic-tac-toe game, and then something that looked like a mathematical equation, which was stupid since the last math she'd taken was Algebra 2 in high school. These days, X was for crossing out the wrong word, and that was all. She pulled the blank sheet out and tossed it away. After lunch on the third rainy day, she called the English department at the university. Jim no longer taught there, not for 8 years, but he still had friends on the faculty and kept in touch. Muriel in the office usually knew where he was, and did this time. Jim Gardner, she told Anderson, was doing a reading in Fall River that night, June 24th, followed by two in Boston over the next 3 nights, followed by readings and lectures in Providence and New Haven, all part of something called the New England Poetry Caravan. Must be Patricia McCardle, Anderson thought, smiling a little. So he'd be back, when, 4th of July? "Gee, I don't know when he'll be back, Bobby," Muriel said. "You know Jim, his last reading's June 30th, that's all I can say for sure." Anderson thanked her and hung up. She looked at the phone thoughtfully, calling up Muriel fully in her mind, another Irish Colleen, but Muriel had the expected red hair, just now reaching the far edge of her prime, round-faced, green-eyed, full-breasted. Had she slept with Jim? Probably. Anderson felt a spark of jealousy, but not much of a spark. Muriel was okay. Just speaking to Muriel made her feel better. Someone who knew who she was, who could think of her as a real person, not just as a customer on the other side of the counter in an Augusta hardware store, or as someone to say how do to over the mailbox. She was solitary by nature, but not monastic. And sometimes simple human contact had a way of fulfilling her when she didn't even know she needed to be fulfilled. And she supposed she knew now why she had wanted to get in contact with Jim. Talking with Muriel had done that, at least. The thing in the woods had stayed on her mind, and the idea that it was some sort of clandestine coffin had grown to a certainty. It wasn't writing she was restless to do, it was digging. She just hadn't wanted to do it on her own. "Looks like I'll have to, though, Pete," she said, sitting down in her rocker by the east window, her reading chair. Peter glanced at her briefly, as if to say, "Whatever you want, babe." Anderson sat forward, suddenly looking at Pete, really looking at him. Peter looked back cheerfully enough, tail thumping on the floor. For a moment, it seemed there was something different about Peter, something so obvious she should be seeing it. If so, she wasn't. She settled back, opening her book, a master's thesis from the University of Nebraska, the most exciting thing about it, the title, Range War and Civil War. She remembered thinking a couple of nights ago, as her sister Anne would think, "You're getting as funny in the head as Uncle Frank, Bobby." Well, maybe. Shortly, she was deep into the thesis, making an occasional note on the legal pad she kept near. Outside, the rain continued to fall. 2. The following day dawned clear and bright and flawless, a postcard summer day with just enough breeze to make the bugs keep their distance. Anderson pottered around the house until almost 10 o'clock, conscious of the growing pressure her mind was putting on her to get out there and dig it up already. She could feel herself consciously pushing back against that urge. Orson Welles again. "We will dig up nobody before it's..." "Oh, shut up, Orson." Her days of simply following the urge of the moment, a lifestyle that had once been catechized by the bald motto, "If it feels good, do it," were over. It had never worked well for her, that philosophy. In fact, almost every bad thing that had happened to her had its roots in some impulsive action. She attached no moral stigma to people who did live their lives according to that impulse. Maybe her intuitions just hadn't been that good. She ate a big breakfast, added a scrambled egg to Peter's gravy train. Peter ate with more appetite than usual, and Anderson put it down to the end of the rainy spell, and then did the washing up. If her dribbles would just stop, everything would be fine. "Forget it. We will stop no period before it's time. Right, Orson? You're fucking A." Bobby went outside, clapped an old straw cowboy hat on her head, and spent the next hour in the garden. Things out there were looking better than they had any right to, given the rain. The peas were coming on, and the corn was rearing up good, as Uncle Frank would have said. She quit at 11. Fuck it. She went around the house to the shed, got the spade and shovel, paused, and added a crowbar. She started out of the shed, went back, and took a screwdriver and an adjustable wrench from the toolbox. Peter started out with her, as he always did, but this time Anderson said, "No, Peter," and pointed back at the house. Peter stopped, looking wounded. He whined and took a tentative step toward Anderson. "No, Peter." Peter gave in and headed back, head down, tail drooping dispiritedly. Anderson was sorry to see him go that way, but Peter's previous reaction to the plate in the ground had been bad. She stood a moment longer on the path which would lead her to the woods road, spade in one hand, shovel and crowbar in the other, watching as Peter mounted the back steps, nosed open the back door, and went into the house. She thought, something was different about him. Is different about him. What is it? She didn't know. But for a moment, almost subliminally, her dream flickered back to her, that arrow of poisonous green light, and her teeth all falling painlessly out of her gums. Then it was gone, and she set off toward the place where it was, that odd thing in the ground, listening to the crickets make their steady re-re-re sound in this small back field, which would soon be ready for its first cutting. 3. At 3 that afternoon, it was Peter who raised her from the semi-daze in which she had been working, making her aware she was 2 damn nears, damn near starving and damn near exhausted. Peter was howling. The sound raised goose flesh on Anderson's back and arms. She dropped the shovel she had been using and backed away from the thing in the earth, the thing that was no plate, no box, not anything she could understand. All she knew for sure was that she had fallen into a strange, thoughtless state she didn't like at all. This time she had done more than lose track of time. She felt as if she had lost track of herself. It was as if someone else had stepped into her head, the way a man would step into a bulldozer or a payloader, simply firing her up and starting to yank the right levers. Peter howled, nose pointing toward the sky, long, chilling, mournful sounds. "Stop it, Peter!" Anderson yelled. And thankfully, Peter did. Any more of that, and she might simply have turned and run. Instead, she fought for control and got it. She backed up another step and cried out when something flapped loosely against her back. At her cry, Peter uttered one more short, yipping sound and fell silent again. Anderson grabbed for whatever had touched her, thinking it might be... Well, she didn't know what she thought it might be, but even before her hand closed on it, she remembered what it was. She had a hazy memory of stopping just long enough to hang her blouse on a bush. Here it was. She took it and put it on, getting the buttons wrong on the first try so that one tail hung down below the other. She rebuttoned it, looking at the dig she had begun. And now that archaeological word seemed to fit what she was doing exactly. Her memories of the 4.5 hours she'd spent digging were like her memory of hanging her blouse on the bush, hazy and broken. They were not memories, they were fragments. But now, looking at what she had done, she felt awe as well as fear, and a mounting sense of excitement. Whatever it was huge, not just big, but huge. The spade, shovel, and crowbar lay at intervals along a 15-foot trench in the forest floor. She had made neat piles of black earth and chunks of rock at regular intervals. Sticking up from this trench, which was about 4 feet deep at the point where Anderson had originally stumbled over 3 inches of protruding gray metal, was the leading edge of some titanic object. Gray metal, some object. You'd ordinarily have a right to expect something better, more specific, from a writer, she thought, arming sweat from her forehead, but she was no longer sure the metal was steel. She thought now it might be some more exotic alloy, beryllium, magnesium, perhaps. And composition aside, she had absolutely no idea what it was. She began to unbutton her jeans so she could tuck in her blouse, then paused. The crotch of the faded Levi's was soaked with blood. Jesus, Jesus Christ. This isn't a period, this is Niagara Falls. She was momentarily frightened, really frightened, then told herself to quit being a ninny. She had gone into some sort of daze and done digging a crew of 4 husky men could have been proud of. Her, a woman who went 125, maybe 130 tops. Of course she was flowing heavily. She was fine. In fact, should be grateful she wasn't cramping as well as gushing. My, how poetic we are today, Bobby, she thought, and uttered a harsh little laugh. All she really needed was to clean herself up. A shower and a change would do fine. The jeans had been ready for either the trash or the rag bag anyway. Now there was one less worry in a troubled, confusing world, right? Right. No big deal. She buttoned her pants again, not tucking the blouse in. No sense ruining that as well, although God knew it wasn't exactly a Dior original. The feel of the sticky wetness down there when she moved made her grimace. God, she wanted to get cleaned up, in a hurry. But instead of starting up the slope to the path, she walked back toward the thing in the earth, again driven to it. Peter howled, and the goose flesh reappeared again. Peter, will you for Christ's sake shut up? She hardly ever shouted at Pete. Really shouted at him, but the goddamn mutt was starting to make her feel like a behavioral psychology subject. Goose flesh when the dog howled instead of saliva at the sound of the bell. But the same principle. Standing close to her find, she forgot about Peter and only stared wonderingly at it. After some moments, she reached out and gripped it. Again, she felt that curious sense of vibration. It sank into her hand and then disappeared. This time, she thought of touching a hull, beneath which very heavy machinery is hard at work. The metal itself was so smooth that it had an almost greasy texture. You expected some of it to come off on your hands. She made a fist and wrapped her knuckles on it. It made a dull sound, like a fist rapping on a thick chunk of mahogany. She stood a moment longer, then took the screwdriver from her back pocket, held it indecisively for a moment, and then, feeling oddly guilty, feeling like a vandal, she drew the blade down the exposed metal. It wouldn't scratch. Her eyes suggested 2 further things, but either or both could have been an optical illusion. The first was that the metal seemed to grow slightly thicker as it went from its edge to the point where it disappeared into the earth. The second was that the edge was slightly curved. These 2 things, if true, suggested an idea that was at once exciting, ludicrous, frightening, impossible, and possessed of a certain mad logic. She ran her palm over the smooth metal, then stepped away. What the hell was she doing petting this goddamn thing while the blood was running down her legs? And her period was the least of her concerns if what she was starting to think just might turn out to be the truth. You better call somebody, Bobby, right now. I'll call Jim when he gets back. Sure, call a poet. Great idea. Then you can call the Reverend Moon, maybe Edward Gorey and Gay and Wilson to draw pictures. Then you can hire a few rock bands and have fucking Woodstock 1988 out here. Get serious, Bobby. Call the state police. No, I want to talk to Jim first. Want him to see it. Want to talk to him about it. Meantime, I'll dig around it some more. It could be dangerous. Yes, not only could be, probably was. Hadn't she felt that? Hadn't Peter felt it? There was something else, too. Coming down the slope from the path this morning, she had found a dead woodchuck, had almost stepped on it. Although the smell when she bent over the animal told her it had been dead 2 days at least, there had been no buzz of flies to warn her. There were no flies at all around old Chuck, and Anderson could not remember ever having seen such a thing. There was no obvious sign of what had killed it, either, but believing that the thing in the ground had had anything to do with it was bullshit of the purest ray serene. Old Chuck had probably gotten some farmer's poison bait and stumbled out here to die. Go home. Change your pants. You're bloody and you stink. She backed away from the thing, then turned and climbed the slope back to the path where Peter jumped clumsily on her and began to lick her hand with an eagerness that was a little pathetic. Even a year ago he would have been trying to nose at her crotch, attracted by the smell there, but not now. Now all he could do was shiver. Your own damn fault, Anderson said. I told you to stay home. All the same, she was glad Peter had come. If he hadn't, Anderson might have worked right through until nightfall, and the idea of coming to in the dark with that thing bulking close by, that idea didn't fetch her. She looked back from the path. The height gave her a more complete view of the thing. It jutted from the ground at a slight angle, she saw. Her impression that the leading edge had a slight curve recurred. A plate. That's what I thought when I first dug around it with my fingers. A steel plate, not a dinner plate, I thought, but maybe even then, with so little of it sticking out of the ground, it was really a dinner plate I was thinking of. Or a saucer. A flying fucking saucer. 4. Back at the house, she showered and changed, using one of the maxi pads, even though the heavy menstrual flow already appeared to be lessening. Then she fixed herself a huge supper of canned baked beans and knockwurst, but she found herself too tired to do much more than pick at it. She put the remains, more than half, down for Peter, and went over to her rocker by the window. The thesis she had been reading was still on the floor beside the chair, her place marked with a torn-off matchbook cover. Her notepad was beside it. She picked it up, turned to a fresh page, and began to sketch the thing in the woods as she had seen it when she took that last look back. She was no great shakes with a pen unless it was words she was making, but she had some small sketching talent. This sketch went very slowly, however, not just because she wanted it to be as exact as she could make it, but because she was so tired. To make matters worse, Peter came over and nuzzled her hand, wanting to be patted. She stroked Peter's head absently, erasing a jag his nose had put into the horizon line of her sketch. Yeah, you're a good dog, great dog. Go check the mail, why don't you? Peter trotted across the living room and nosed the screen door open. Anderson went back to work on her sketch, glancing up once to see Peter do his world-famous canine mail retrieval trick. He put his left forepaw up on the mailbox post and then began to swipe at the door of the box. Joe Paulson, the postman, knew about Peter and always left it ajar. He got the door down, then lost his balance before he could hook the mail out with his paw. Anderson winced a little. Until this year, Peter had never lost his balance. Getting the mail had been his pièce de résistance, better than playing dead Viet Cong, and much better than anything mundane like sitting up or speaking for a dog biscuit. It wowed everyone who saw him do it, and Peter knew it. But these days it was a painful ritual to watch. It made Anderson feel the way she imagined she would feel if she saw Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers as they were now, trying to do one of their old dance routines. The dog managed to get up on the post again, and this time Peter hooked the mail. A catalog and a letter, or bill, yes, with the end of the month coming, it was more likely a bill, out of the box with the first swipe of his paw. It fluttered to the road, and as Peter picked it up, Anderson dropped her eyes back to her sketch, telling herself to stop banging the goddamn funeral bell for Peter every 2 minutes. The dog actually looked half alive tonight. There had been nights recently when he'd had to totter up on his hind legs 3 or 4 times before he was able to get his mail, which usually came to no more than a free sample from Procter & Gamble or an advertising circular from Kmart. Anderson stared at her sketch closely, absently shading in the trunk of the big pine tree with the split top. It wasn't 100% accurate, but it was pretty close. She'd gotten the angle of the thing right anyway. She drew a box around it, then turned the box into a cube, as if to isolate the thing. The curve was obvious enough in her sketch, but had it really been there? Yes. And what was she calling a metal plate? It was really a hull, wasn't it? A glassy, smooth, rivetless hull. You're losing your mind, Bobby. You know that, don't you? Peter scratched on the screen to be let in. Anderson went to the door, still looking at her sketch. Peter came in and dropped the mail on a chair in the hallway. Then he walked slowly down to the kitchen, presumably to see if there was anything he had overlooked on Anderson's plate. Anderson picked up the 2 pieces of mail and wiped them on the leg of her jeans with a little grimace of disgust. It was a good trick, granted, but dog spit on the mail was never going to be one of her favorite things. The catalog was from Radio Shack. They wanted to sell her a word processor. The bill was from Central Maine Power. That made her think briefly of Jim Gardner again. She tossed both on the table in the hall, went back to her chair, sat down again, flipped to a fresh page, and quickly copied her original sketch. She frowned at the mild arc, which was probably a bit of extrapolation, as if she had dug down maybe 12 or 14 feet instead of just 4. Well, so what? A little extrapolation didn't bother her. Hell, that was part of a fiction writer's business, and people who thought it belonged solely to science fiction or fantasy writers had never looked through the other end of the telescope, had never been faced with the problem of filling in white spaces that no history could provide. Things like what had happened to the people who had colonized Roanoke Island off the North Carolina coast, and then simply disappeared, for example, leaving no mark but the inexplicable word Croatoan, carved on a tree. Or the Easter Island monoliths, or why the citizens of a little town in Utah called Blessing had all suddenly gone crazy, or so it seemed, on the same day in the summer of 1884. If you didn't know for sure, it was okay to imagine, until and unless you found out different. There was a formula by which circumference could be determined from an arc. She was quite sure of it. She had forgotten what the damn thing was. That was the only problem. But she could maybe get a rough idea, always assuming her impression of just how much the thing's edge curved was accurate, by estimating the thing's center point. Bobby went back to the hall table and opened its middle drawer, which was a sort of catch-all. She rooted past untidy bundles of canceled checks, dead CD and 9-volt batteries. For some reason, she had never been able to shit-can old batteries. What you did with old batteries was throw them in a drawer, God knew why. It was just the battery graveyard instead of the one the elephants were supposed to have. Bunches of rubber bands and wide red canning rubbers, unanswered fan letters, she could no more throw out an unanswered fan letter than a dead battery, and recipes jotted on file cards. At the very bottom of the drawer was a litter of small tools, and among them she found what she was looking for, a compass with a yellow stub of pencil sleeved into the armature. Sitting in the rocker again, Anderson turned to a fresh sheet and drew the leading edge of the thing in the earth for the third time. She tried to keep it in scale, but drew it a little bigger this time, not bothering with the surrounding trees and only suggesting the trench for the sake of perspective. "Okay, guesswork," she said, and dug the point of the compass into the yellow legal pad below the curved edge. She adjusted the compass's arc so it traced that edge fairly accurately, and then she swept the compass around in a complete circle. She looked at it, then wiped her mouth with the heel of her hand. Her lips suddenly felt too loose and too wet.
"Bullshit," she whispered.
But it wasn't bullshit. Unless her estimate of the edge's curvature and of midpoint were both wildly off the beam, she had unearthed the edge of an object which was at least 300 yards in circumference. Anderson dropped the compass and the pad on the floor and looked out the window. Her heart was beating too hard. 5. As the sun went down, Anderson sat on her back porch, staring across her garden toward the woods, and listened to the voices in her head. In her junior year at college, she had taken a psychology department seminar on creativity. She had been amazed, and a little relieved, to discover that she was not concealing some private neurosis. Almost all imaginative people heard voices. Not just thoughts, but actual voices inside their heads. Different personae, each as clearly defined as voices on an old-time radio show. They came from the right side of the brain, the teacher explained. The side which is most commonly associated with visions and telepathy and that striking human ability to create images by drawing comparisons and making metaphors. There are no such things as flying saucers.
Oh, yeah? Who says so?
The Air Force, for one. They closed the books on flying saucers 20 years ago. They were able to explain all but 3% of all verified sightings, and they have said those last three were almost certainly caused by ephemeral atmospheric conditions, stuff like sun dogs, clear air turbulence, pockets of clear air electricity. Hell, the Lubbock lights were front-page news, and all they turned out to be was, well, there were these traveling packs of moths, see? And the Lubbock street lights hit their wings and reflected big light-colored moving shapes onto the low cloud masses that a stagnant weather pattern kept over the town for a week. Most of the country spent that week thinking someone dressed like Michael Rennie in The Day the Earth Stood Still was going to come walking up Lubbock's main drag with his pet robot Gort clanking along beside him, demanding to be taken to our leader. And they were moths. Do you like it? Don't you have to like it?
This voice was so clear it was amusing. It was that of Dr. Klingerman, who had taught the seminar. It lectured her with good old Klingy's unfailing, if rather shrill, enthusiasm. Anderson smiled and lit a cigarette. Smoking a little too much tonight, but the damn things were going stale anyway.
In 1947, an Air Force captain named Mantell flew too high while he was chasing a flying saucer, what he thought was a flying saucer. He blacked out. His plane crashed. Mantell was killed. He died chasing a reflection of Venus on a high scud of clouds, a sun dog, in other words. So there are reflections of moths, reflections of Venus, and probably reflections in a golden eye as well, Bobby, but there are no flying saucers.
Then what is that in the ground?
The voice of the lecturer fell still. It didn't know. So in its place came Anne's voice, telling her for the third time that she was getting funny in the head, getting weird like Uncle Frank, saying they'd be measuring her for one of those canvas coats you wear backwards soon. They'd cart her up to the asylum in Bangor, or the one in Juniper Hill, and she could rave about flying saucers in the woods while she wove baskets.
It was Sissy's voice, all right. She could call her on the phone right now, tell her what had happened, and get that scripture by chapter and by verse. She knew it.
But was it right?
No, it wasn't. Anne would equate her sister's mostly solitary life with madness, no matter what Bobby did or said. And yes, the idea that the thing in the earth was some sort of spaceship certainly was mad. But was playing with the possibility, at least until it was disproven, mad? Anne would think so, but Anderson did not. Nothing wrong with keeping an open mind.
Yet the speed with which the possibility had occurred to her.
She got up and went inside. Last time she had fooled with that thing in the woods, she had slept for 12 hours. She wondered if she could expect a similar sleep marathon this time.
She felt almost tired enough to sleep 12 hours, God knew. Leave it alone, Bobby. It's dangerous.
But she wouldn't, she thought, pulling off her Opus for President t-shirt. Not just yet. The trouble with living alone, she had discovered, and the reason why most people she knew didn't like to be alone, even for a little while, was that the longer you lived alone, the louder those voices on the right side of your brain got. As the yardsticks of rationality began to shrink in the silence, those voices did not just request attention, they demanded it. It was easy to become frightened of them, to think they meant madness after all.
Anne would sure think they did, Bobby thought, climbing into bed.
The lamp cast a clean and comforting circle of light on the counterpane, but she left the thesis she'd been reading on the floor. She kept expecting the cramps that usually accompanied her occasional early and heavy menstrual flow, but so far they hadn't come. Not that she was anxious for them to put in an appearance, you should understand. She crossed her hands behind her head and looked at the ceiling.
No, you're not crazy at all, Bobby, she thought. You think guard's getting wiggy, but you're perfectly all right. Isn't that also a sign that you're wobbling? There's even a name for it. Denial and substitution. I'm all right. It's the world that's crazy.
All true. But she still felt firmly in control of herself, and sure of one thing. She was saner in Haven than she had been in Cleves Mills, and much saner than she had been in Utica. A few more years in Utica, a few more years around Sissy, and she would have been as mad as a hatter. Anderson believed Anne actually saw driving her close relatives crazy as part of her job? No, nothing so mundane, as part of her sacred mission in life. She knew what was really troubling her, and it wasn't the speed with which the possibility had occurred. It was the feeling of certainty. She would keep an open mind, but the struggle would be to keep it open in favor of what Anne would call sanity, because she knew what she had found. And it filled her with fear and awe and a restless, moving excitement. See, Anne, old Bobby didn't move up to Sticksville and go crazy. Old Bobby moved up here and went sane. Insanity is limiting possibilities, Anne. Can you dig it? Insanity is refusing to go down certain paths of speculation, even though the logic is there. Like a token for the turnstile. See what I mean? No? Of course you don't. You don't, and you never did. Then go away, Anne. Stay in Utica and grind your teeth in your sleep until there's nothing left of them. Make whoever is mad enough to stay within range of your voice crazy be my guest, but stay out of my head. The thing in the earth was a ship from space. There. It was out. No more bullshit. Never mind Anne. Never mind the Lubbock lights or how the Air Force had closed its file on flying saucers. Never mind the chariots of the gods or the Bermuda Triangle or how Elijah was drawn up to heaven in a wheel of fire. Never mind any of it. Her heart knew what her heart knew. It was a ship, and it had either landed or crash-landed a long time ago, maybe millions of years ago. God! She lay in bed, hands behind her head. She was calm enough, but her heart was beating fast, fast, fast. Then another voice, and this was the voice of her dead grandfather repeating something Anne's voice had said earlier. Leave it alone, Bobby. It's dangerous. That momentary vibration, her first premonition, suffocating and positive, that she had found the edge of some weird steel coffin. Peter's reaction. Starting her period early, only spotting here at the farm, but bleeding like a stuck pig when she was close to it. Losing track of time. Sleeping the clock all the way around. And don't forget old Chuck the woodchuck. Chuck had smelled gassy and decomposed, but there were no flies. No flies on Chuck, you might say. None of that shit adds up to Shinola. I'll buy the possibility of a ship in the earth, because no matter how crazy it sounds at first, the logic's still there. But there's no logic to the rest of this stuff. They're loose beads rolling around on the table. Thread them onto a string and maybe I'll buy it. I'll think about it anyway. Okay? Her grandfather's voice again. That slow, authoritative voice. The only one in the house that had even been able to strike Anne silent as a kid.
Those things all happened after you found it, Bobby. That's your strain.
No, not enough. Easy enough to talk back to her grandfather now. The man was 16 years in his grave. But it was her grandfather's voice that followed her down to sleep, nevertheless.
Leave it alone, Bobby. It's dangerous. And you know that, too.